Last night, the North Carolina Board of Elections announced changes to voting rules in counties impacted by Hurricane Helene. And some people are concerned.
Some people? Which people? Jesse Waters of Fox News?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No,
it ain't. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
I am a little scared.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP. And Rochester, New York's WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV. Out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN. Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ. Up in Seattle on KODX. In Richmond, Virginia on WRWK. Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR. Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR. And Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM950. KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet. So on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from BradBlog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another edition of the Bradcast. Ezzie Doyen, are you holding up? Are you in one piece here?
I am, but on pins and needles with waiting to find out what's going to happen with this monster storm, Hurricane Milton.
In fact, as we go to air today, Milton is approaching the central west coast of Florida. Millions have been evacuated, hopefully everywhere, from Tampa all down to the southwest part of the state, as this storm has now grown in size, even as it has been downgraded from a Category 5 to, as we go to air, a Category 3. Multiple tornadoes have already broken out around the state, as the National Hurricane Center continues to warn about, first and foremost, what could be an unsurvivable 12 feet or more of storm surge in some places, including potentially Tampa Bay. Not to mention a wind and flooding from rainfall that they are describing as anywhere from devastating to catastrophic, with Milton set to make landfall on Wednesday night or early on Thursday. Now, at the moment, we are largely, as Desi says, in watch and wait mode. And given the timing of Milton's landfall, since some of our affiliate stations run the broadcast the next morning, well, many of you folks at this point may already know more about Milton's landfall and potential destruction than we do this afternoon as we go to air. So, with that in mind, we will almost certainly have much more on Milton on our next broadcast. But since Milton right now is not the only storm of note, with folks still struggling with fallout from last week's Hurricane Helene, including in some of the same areas that are about to be hit by Milton in Florida, in our climate-changed world, allow me to focus for today, at least, on some of Helene's fallout for the moment, as we are also now less than 4 weeks away from Election Day, with early and mail-in voting already underway now in many states, including the battleground state of Arizona beginning today. Since Helene blew ashore just about 2 weeks ago in Florida and then ripped its way up through five other states in the U.S. Southeast, we've been keeping our eyes on how voters may be affected in the most devastated areas, particularly in parts of North Carolina, a battleground state which was severely damaged, especially in the western part of the state, and where many are still struggling today. This week, in a unanimous bipartisan vote, the North Carolina State Board of Elections approved a list of emergency measures for the hardest hit areas, including allowing affected voters to request and receive absentee ballots in person at their county elections office up until the day before Election Day, which is November 5th, and reassigning poll workers where needed in order to fill staffing gaps, because some of the folks who are going to be poll workers have been dislocated themselves. According to Charlotte's WCNC, Karen Brinson Bell, the executive director of the State Board of Elections, said at this week's emergency meeting, quote, "Today's actions will allow us to move forward, adapt to the circumstances these counties and voters face, and ensure every eligible voter is able to cast their ballot." Well, that is good news, if she's right, and I hope she is. The changes come as some polling locations face severe damage, with the state calling on the National Guard to help. Brinson Bell said, "We can erect National Guard tents, FEMA representatives. There are trailers or RVs that they can bring in, and we can set those up." But being able to go to the county election headquarters to pick up and vote on an absentee ballot may, in fact, be very critical for voters whose polling places cannot be opened this year due to ongoing storm damage. And as the state board has allowed, voters who may be displaced already have an absentee ballot can deliver that absentee ballot to any polling location. Mail-in ballots that had already gone out before the storm, that's another issue with absentee voting already underway. Brinson Bell said some ballots were lost in the storm, presumably on their way back to the county, but that they are still working to find them. Any voter who's concerned about the status of their ballot can certainly, if they had made the request, she says they can sign up for Ballot Tracks, which is a service that North Carolina and other states provide to all voters who vote absentee by mail, where they can follow their ballot in the mail stream to make sure it, in fact, arrives. She says the state is doing what it can to support all voters under these unprecedented circumstances and debunked rumors, adding any claims that the board is working in a manner that benefits a particular political party are patently false, she says. And I'm sure you're not surprised, but those rumors that that evidence-free disinformation has already begun on social media, and naturally, it is being amplified on the right-wing propaganda outlet known as Fox News, as was heard last night on that stooge Jesse Waters program, as they actually struggled to report what was good news for voters. And by the way, something that they note that the Trump campaign actually claimed to be in favor of, they struggled to somehow report that, if they could, as bad news.
The storm just isn't impacting people's lives. It's affecting the election. Last night, the North Carolina Board of Elections announced changes to voting rules in counties impacted by Hurricane Helene. And some people are concerned. Senior political correspondent Kevin Cork is here. Kevin.
Evening, Jesse. They're talking about major changes in the voting process. Now, this is, they say, designed to help displaced voters in the Tar Heel State not only cast their ballots, but also make sure they have their voices heard this November. However, some Republicans are expressing deep reservations about the plan because of concerns about voter integrity. Now, the changes were approved by unanimous vote by the bipartisan board, coming just 10 days before early voting begins in the battleground state, and even as mail-in voting is already underway. Now, a couple of the changes I want to tell you about, including this: voters in the 13 counties that have been heavily affected by Hurricane Helene will now have more ways to obtain and deliver absentee ballots. By the way, more storms coming, possibly. Voters in those counties will have longer to apply for absentee ballots. They'll be allowed to drop their ballots off anywhere in the state, not just in their home county. There'll also be teams that'll be sent to storm relief centers to help register more voters and, you guessed it, collect more ballots. What's more, the county boards will also be able to, by a bipartisan majority, hire poll workers from other counties and then move them all around the state to ensure there are enough experienced workers at each voting site. Now, the problem is, say critics, Jesse, we don't know where they're going to draw these poll workers from. And with ballots being able to be dropped off anywhere in the state, how can anyone accurately contest voter turnout discrepancies, say, in different counties? And keep this in mind, North Carolina was one of the last states to report back in 2020. It took them 10 days to certify the general election, despite being a relatively small state. Now, I can also add this very quickly. President Trump's team, the Trump Vance campaign, issued a statement tonight asking for more access for North Carolinians. They say it is super important that the people who've already suffered from the storm don't lose their right to take part in this important election. And big amen. For that, Jesse.
I don't know if I love or hate these late changes in the election law, but I know Mark Elias, the Democrat election lawyer who specializes in shenanigans, loves it. So that makes me a little suspicious, but who knows what's going to happen? It could work out.
Yes.
Good Lord.
Who knows? It could work out. The Trump campaign wants more access, but Jesse Waters doesn't know. Maybe it's good and maybe it's bad because the Democrat election attorney Mark Elias, who does not specialize in shenanigans, but actually specializes in election law and fights for voting access for all voters, well, he's in favor of it. So this must be bad. Maybe. Who knows? Maybe it could work out. As you know, North Carolina is a very closely divided battleground state this year in the presidential race, with Kamala Harris and Donald Trump largely deadlocked there in pre-election polling averages. But what Jesse and Fox News are trying to do there is essentially lay the groundwork that if Donald Trump loses the state, well, they'll have something to claim was fraudulent about the way that the state election board, in a bipartisan, unanimous way, by the way, changed the rules in order to accommodate voters in areas devastated by one of the worst and most devastating storms in 50 years. Much as the way Trump's Republican Party and Fox News used the COVID pandemic after 2020, after Trump lost, to then claim, well, we were robbed somehow because, you know, the rules were changed to make it easier for people to vote without risking death. So they're clearly planning to do the same thing here in the event that Trump loses in North Carolina. But make no mistake, this was already the plan for Republicans even before Hurricane Helene blew ashore. According to Reuters, at the end of last month, Republicans had already filed dozens and dozens of lawsuits around the country. Not suits that they would necessarily win, but suits that they could then use to point to after the election in the event Donald Trump loses. As Reuters writes, in Arizona, one of seven competitive U.S. states that are expected to decide the 2024 election, an advocacy group founded by Donald Trump advisor Stephen Miller is advancing a bold and novel legal theory that judges can actually throw out election results over, quote, failures or irregularities by local officials. The lawsuit by Miller's America First Legal Foundation, a far-right advocacy group largely representing Donald Trump's interests, says the court in such cases should be able to simply toss out results and order new rounds of voting.
Good Lord.
But only in two counties in Arizona, where Democratic candidate Vice President Kamala Harris happens to be leading Donald Trump in the polls by a razor-thin margin. Of course, they're only suing to make that case in the counties where Harris is leading, leading Trump in Arizona. Those are the ones that they may just have to throw out and run again. Almost 4 years after Trump and his allies tried and failed to overturn his election defeat in 2020 with a flurry of more than 60 hastily arranged lawsuits, all but one of them failed completely, even when they came before Trump-appointed judges, by the way. Republicans have launched an aggressive legal campaign, laying the groundwork in advance this time to challenge potential losses afterwards, whether there is any actual evidence of fraud either now or then. The Republican National Committee says it is involved in more than 120 lawsuits right now across 26 states in a strategy that many legal experts and voting rights groups say is meant to undercut confidence in the system. You think? Republicans say the lawsuits are aimed at restoring confidence in elections by ensuring people do not vote illegally. After Trump and allies falsely claimed that his 2020 election loss to Joe Biden was tainted by widespread fraud. In fact, it wasn't, or if it was, Team Trump has still been unable to offer any evidence of such fraud in any state in the 4 years that they have been pretending that this happened. While the Arizona case is a long shot, legal experts say it fits with a pattern of Republican-backed lawsuits that appear aimed at sowing doubts about the legitimacy of the election before it occurs in order to provide fodder for challenging the results after the fact. And make no mistake, this is what will be happening if Donald Trump loses. If he's named the winner, there will be no claims of by Republicans afterwards of fraudulent voting, even though they are claiming now without evidence in lawsuit after lawsuit all over the country that tens of thousands of non-citizens are on the rolls and will be voting this year. Of course, we know that either they know that there are not tens of thousands of citizens doing that, and or they don't actually care. Because as we reported, I think it was a week or so ago now, after making those claims for months in Arizona, the Arizona Republican Party actually opposed a legal effort to remove some 98,000 voters from the rolls in the state after an actual glitch, a real glitch in the state's voter database, was discovered to reveal that those voters, 98,000 of them, had not given proof of citizenship with their voter record, as is now required when registering to vote in Arizona. There's no reason to believe that they are non-citizens, but because of this glitch, there's no proof of citizenship attached to their voting records. But despite that, after initially claiming that the error proved that non-citizens were on the rolls, and voting without any evidence actually being the case of that being the case, the Arizona Republican Party eventually opposed that lawsuit because the Democratic Secretary of State there showed that of those 98,000 voters, more of them were Republican than Democratic. So, they can't remove those voters. It's too late to do that. Under federal law, the Arizona Republicans argued. These suits brought by Stephen Miller's groups and others, according to Columbia Law School professor Richard Brifalt, quote, is part of creating the narrative that there will be irregularities that will then require outside intervention. Outside intervention, like a judge saying, yeah, we got to toss it all out and start all over again. In other words, Republicans do not actually care if they win these suits. They just want to be able to refer to them later, politically, if they lose at the polls, so that they can then call on elected state and federal Republicans to somehow vote to challenge or reverse the results in either a GOP-controlled state legislature or in Congress on January 6th. Or even have the results tossed out by one of Donald Trump's rogue judges who may determine that there's enough doubt about these results that we need to do it all over again, citing these lawsuits that were filed before the election or something. According to Reuters, a spokesperson for the Republican National Committee said the party's top priority is fixing what they say are problems with our voting system before Election Day, to ensure that no ballots are illegally cast. Quote, this gives our voters confidence that their ballot will be counted properly and in turn inspires voter turnout, said an RNC spokesperson. The Harris campaign said in a statement that the Republicans are, quote, scheming to sow distrust in our elections and undermine our democracy so they can cry foul when they lose.
And they are starting early and often.
I would only correct the statement from the Harris-Walz campaign to say that's if they lose.
And if Trump wins, then Republicans will just pretend like none of this ever happened.
And it's not only in Arizona. In Michigan, another closely contested state, Republicans are suing to prevent state agencies from expanding access to voter registration, to restrict the use of mobile voting sites like vans that allow people to vote in underserved communities. In Nevada and other states, Trump allies are seeking to purge voter rolls of allegedly ineligible voters. Though the deadline for systematically culling rolls in time for the election has long passed, as the Arizona Republican Party has been forced to admit. And in Pennsylvania, Republicans are fighting to enforce strict mail-in voting rules and limit voters' ability to correct mistakes on their ballots. They're doing this all over the country. And again, it doesn't matter if they win or lose. Just injecting the doubt is what is important, because they will then use that later if they need to. Uncertainty could give local officials and state legislatures the opportunity to meddle with the results, according to Sophia Lynn Lakin, an attorney litigating voting rights cases on behalf of the ACLU. She's been a guest on this program, I believe. For example, officials could try to throw out votes or refuse to certify the outcome. Quote, she says, it's about laying the groundwork for there to be enough doubt in the election process that a political maneuver could be brought to bear to impact the outcome, she said. So make no mistake, this is coming. If he loses, this is coming. That is what all of this is about, all of these lawsuits in advance. And you're going to hear a lot of these seemingly fruitless challenges before the election in order to help them make their case afterwards. That's why Jesse Waters on Fox News was pretending, I don't know, maybe that's good, maybe it's not. I'll let you know on November 6th. And both Hurricane Helene and now Hurricane Milton are likely to give them even more opportunities to fraudulently claim fraud. But what about real claims of fraud or just inappropriate behavior by actual election officials? What if poll workers see something inappropriate by fellow poll workers or election officials that really does need to be highlighted and reported? Is there an avenue for real whistleblowers to report such things in this environment? And if so, how do we tell the real whistleblowers from the fake ones? Or even the ones who think they are reporting real concerns but actually are not? There is a lot to figure out here. Thankfully, this year, the Government Accountability Project, which has been supporting real whistleblowers since 1977, well, they've now set up a democracy protection initiative to help us all do exactly that. And the director of that program, Dana Gold, she joins us next to explain. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad here at the Bradcast and bradblog.com. We fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to do it. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate to make an automated monthly pledge of any amount you like, or even just a one-time only contribution to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. The fight for voting rights, civil rights, and to save our planet continues. Please help us continue that fight independently over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate right now. Go ahead, do it right now. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. We have long reported at BradBlog.com and here on the Bradcast on various whistleblowers within the election industry, most notably employees or contractors working with voting machine companies. Longtime followers may, in fact, remember, for example, way back in 2005 and 2006, when I reported on serious vulnerabilities in then new touchscreen voting systems and computerized optical scan tabulators made by a company named Diebold. Their systems had been very quickly manufactured and deployed in the wake of disputes over punch card voting systems in Florida in the 2000 election just a few years earlier. But as we detailed at great length at the time, the new systems were vulnerable to both manipulation and programming error from both foreign and domestic sources. In 2006, for example, after helping supply computer security analysts at Princeton University with a Diebold touchscreen voting machine to allow for the first time independent testing of such machines, I reported at the Brad blog and at Salon at the time that the analysts were able to essentially hack into the system in about 60 seconds time and implant malware that could pass itself from machine to machine to flip election results, and there would be little possibility of detection. Now, I should note, given that much of my reporting from that era has subsequently been bastardized and misused by Donald Trump supporters like Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell and Mike Lindell and others following the 2020 election in order to claim that voting machines had been manipulated through such means, that in fact, I never reported as much myself. I reported on the confirmed vulnerabilities of these systems, that they could be misused in such a way, not that they had been up through that time or even since, to my knowledge. Now, one of the analysts at Princeton University, by the way, a student in the university's computer lab at the time, who was able to demonstrate that the Diebold systems that I gave them to look at could be hacked in 60 seconds, and by the way, even opened up with the very same identical generic key that was at the time used to open hotel minibars, he was a guy by the name of Alex Halderman. He is now a doctor of computer science, serving as professor at Michigan University, the University of Michigan, and he is now one of the nation's leading experts in voting system security. You may recall our recent reporting on a trial in federal court in Georgia in a lawsuit brought by the nonpartisan election watchdog Coalition for Good Governance, challenging the use of the state's brand new touchscreen voting systems made by Dominion. They are the machines that actually replaced their old Diebold machines after the federal judge in the case back in 2019 effectively banned those systems, those 20-year-old systems in the state after finding them to be wildly insecure. But Alex Halderman was one of the star witnesses in that recent trial as he demonstrated in court how the new Dominion touchscreen systems could also be hacked by just about any voter at the polling place with little more than a ballpoint pen. Yes, seriously. But I digress, if only a bit. Halderman's findings on the old Diebold systems way back in 2006 followed on an exclusive series of 2005 whistleblower reports at bradblog.com from a source, a Diebold insider who, at the time, though I knew who they were, still worked with the company and did not wish to be identified publicly by name. I called the source Deep Throat at the time, describing how the company's lead programmers admitted to my source that the security on their systems was in fact terrible, and that a branch of the Department of Homeland Security at the time had already quietly issued a public warning about it back in 2004, about a, quote, undocumented backdoor in those voting systems that was wide open to the potential injection of malware. Deep Throat was not the only such whistleblower that I've reported on over the years, but most of them have been employees or contractors working with voting machine vendors or at the companies themselves. Election officials serving as whistleblowers, however, well, they have been fewer and farther between over the years. But as Molly Bloom, reported last week at Route 50, a news website geared toward the broad community of state and local government officials across the country, quote, while federal whistleblowers like Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning may loom large in the public imagination, lawyers at the Government Accountability Project, a nonprofit whistleblower protection organization, are preparing for a potential influx of calls from a new type of client this fall, election workers. Local, county, and state election officials, poll workers, and even contractors like voting machine operators are best positioned to identify and warn of attempts to interfere with the election process, according to a whistleblower's guide in battleground states that was published last week by the longtime whistleblower support organization. Quote, these are just public servants who we are depending on to really protect our democracy, said Dana Gold, director of the Government Accountability Project's Democracy Protection Initiative. The guide, she says, is a way to ensure election workers know, quote, that they have the right to speak up and that they don't have to do it alone. As former President Donald Trump and other Republicans continue to cast doubt on the integrity of the American election process, threats to election workers have intensified. Nearly 40% of local election officials reported experiencing threats, harassment, or abuse last year alone. That, according to a Brennan Center for Justice survey, and 62% reported concerns about political leaders engaging in efforts to interfere with how election officials do their job. Joining us now is Dana Gold, who for more than 30 years has represented and worked with numerous whistleblowers on issues like nuclear weapons risks, food safety, climate science censorship, banking fraud, illegal electronic surveillance, and immigration abuses. She is the Senior Director of Advocacy and Strategy at the Nonpartisan Government Accountability Project, founded way back in 1977 in the wake of our late friend Dan Ellsberg's landmark release of the Pentagon Papers. And as noted, she is the director of the organization's new Democracy Protection Initiative. Dana Gold, thank you for joining us on the broadcast today.
Great to be here. Thanks so much.
As explained, I'm familiar with whistleblowing from folks who have legitimately blown the whistle on corporate voting system vendors, but less so from election officials or election workers themselves in the course of an actual election. And I want to discuss what sort of whistles that they might need to blow this year or have already done in years past. But first, the Government Accountability Project created its Democracy Protection Initiative in 2020. Was that before or after the 2020 election itself, Dana?
It was before. It was before. And it was an anticipation of, in a highly partisan environment, that we were very concerned about foreign and insider threat, illegal election interference. And we recognized that potential threat, and we worked on training kind of similar to what we're doing this year, but focusing on a different landscape of threat at the federal level, because so much had been politicized during the Trump administration. DOJ had been weaponized, Department of State had been weaponized and politicized, that we were very concerned, Department of Homeland Security, that federal employees might be in the best position to see problems and would need support in speaking up. And so we worked on doing outreach to educate federal employees and contractors about their whistleblower rights, their rights to speak up. And we also recruited an army of pro bono attorneys to work with us to do rapid response to support them potentially. And then had an army of partners, of good government, pro-democracy partners working with us, ready to be able to support those whistleblowers and move potential information safely and effectively. We didn't have a lot of whistleblowers, though. I mean, it was really, we had a fire extinguisher ready. And as we know, the 2020 election ended up being actually quite secure and fair and free and administered safely. And so, so that was in 2020. And we realized that the threat landscape has changed in 2024.
How has
it? And so, well, I think it's a state game now. Go ahead.
Well, no, I was going to say, how has it changed? I guess you were focusing more on federal workers, federal whistleblowers, blowing the whistle on foreign interference. Now it seems like you're focusing more on election officials, election work, poll workers around the states.
Yeah, I think it's not that it's interesting. I think that the research shows that there are four real primary threats to elections in this very hyper-partisan environment, in high-stakes, battleground stakes particularly. We have risks of foreign interference still. We have a highly politically violent environment, which you referenced in the intro. We have the risk of disinformation being spread widely, which can have the result in suppression, delay, eroding confidence in the election results, and potential insider threats. So people who are essentially election deniers, who believe that the 2020 election was stolen, despite every piece of evidence that shows that election was free and fair and did not have interference, and people's votes were calculated correctly. So in this environment, the election officials and workers are, that's where we're seeing, attacks on election officials and workers. We see state legislatures changing voter laws up until the last minute, right? In Georgia, they're still fighting about new election laws that are being passed, which, can create an incentive to challenge, challenge the results. And so this is a really volatile, it's a very volatile environment. And election officials and workers who are really the public servants responsible for making sure that our votes are counted, and they have done that historically, successfully, that they're on the front lines, and they may be in the best position to see efforts to suppress the vote. They may see insider threats. An election worker, we saw Tina Peters, the Colorado election official, who was just convicted of fraud, right? Because she was in another for 9 years,
right?
Because she allowed someone to come in illegally and access the voting machines, had the security cameras turned off. There may have been election workers who would have seen that Tina Peters had done that, who could have blown the whistle to stop that from happening, for instance. So I think that there are opportunities for election officials and workers who may see problems and feel very scared and not clear about how to raise that concern, especially if the threat is their supervisor, right? Or, and so someone in a position of power. Mm-hmm. And so what are they going to do, to make sure that the election is protected and administered fairly, consistent with their oath of office and their duty to do so?
You raise a whole lot of points in that answer, which gives me a whole lot of questions to ask you about it. Because there were folks, in fact, who claimed to be whistleblowers after the 2020 election, who were reported on as such largely by right-wing media outlets, and whose stories appeared to kind of crumble pretty quickly after they were actually examined by actual journalists and officials and so forth, finding that they either made up the story or that it was something that they had heard someone say that someone else had said. And you referenced Tina Peters and her recent sentence to 9 years for tampering with voting systems. I think that she actually sees herself to this day as a whistleblower. Yeah. Dana, how does GAP tell the Government Accountability Project tell the difference in such cases between a real whistleblower and essentially a partisan operative?
Yeah, it is such a great question, and it's actually in some ways the other piece of the service we're trying to offer, right? Which is to ensure that legitimate whistleblowers are protected and that their information is moved in ways that is safe and effective to ensure the integrity of the vote, but to also vet and make sure that false claims of illegal voter interference mm-hmm. do not surface to create a narrative that is false, right? That in itself is a form of disinformation, creating an anchor to reject or to cause so doubt in the election results. It's really complicated operating
yeah.
environment.
Yes,
and so, yeah, so to your point, you know, that case was settled recently, I guess earlier this year, with the fake whistleblower, essentially, which is deeply damaging to us, that the currency of the term whistleblower, and we've seen this, right? You actually yeah. talked about this in one of your recent podcasts about the erosion of the power of language, mm-hmm. you know, that has been co-opted, you know, the same, you know, Cleta Mitchell with her election yes. integrity project.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's like, you know, so anyone would think that like, you know, that we could be, you know, cause, I mean, it's very hard. You have democracy, truth, which is the currency
yep.
of a whistleblower, which we, you know, we call verified information, essentially of facts.
Uh-huh.
You know, you can't even use the word truth anymore. Right. And so the term whistleblower, which has increased in its currency as someone who does not have skin in the game, you know, to, you know, other than doing their duty, essentially having access to that information, being credible because of the risk involved with raising a concern. We have seen false whistleblowers trotted out, right, as yeah. Or claims of false whistleblowers, which is so damaging to real whistleblowers.
Well, it's
right,
it's,
because it's a terrible situation to be in, which is why we're trying to be in the middle of it in some ways, because of our record over nearly 50 years of uh-huh. being able to verify claims, of being able to ensure that an employee understands their rights, risks, and options, to be able to keep them as safe as possible in moving their information. Sometimes that might mean quietly, right? So they're not made vulnerable,
right?
So that partners can act on that information, authorities can act on that information without, and the issue could be addressed very quickly, right? So I think it's going to be a very complicated operating environment for exactly the reason that you identify.
Yeah, it's also, I mean, I suppose a double or triply difficult, because a lot of these people who claim to be whistleblowers actually think they are whistleblowers. They may have
yes.
Bad information, but they don't feel that way. They actually
yep.
believe it. They're not, you know, operatives trying to con you. So
yep.
I
think that's so interesting that yeah. you said they may believe, and that
yeah.
is true.
Yeah.
You know, the standard in the law, which is a whole thing we can talk about, which is complicated in this landscape, in this state-based landscape, but it's usually a reasonable belief, which is measurable as both objective and subjective. Like, you have to have proof.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be able to shore it up. You can't just believe it. You know, and mm-hmm. I think about Tina Peters engaging in her own illegal activity
mm-hmm.
to follow, you know, which was completely inconsistent with her duty as an election official.
Right.
To prove false claims that you know, to date are not true, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in doing so, you know, interfered with the election. I mean, it is why that standard of reasonableness is needs to be shored up with facts, verification.
And can a case be made with someone like Tina Peters that she is not a whistleblower, because she didn't say, here, look, this is what I found. Here is a bad code that was inside the machines. She did this secretly. She released the data. Because I do know a number of election officials who actually allowed people to look at the systems, look at the source code. And they did find actual real concerns, but they put their names on it. They made it public.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a secret project as it was with Tina
yep.
Peters.
Yeah, I think there's a way to go about making a disclosure, again, rooted in verification,
mm-hmm.
That is responsible and also safe for that person, right? And so, yeah, go ahead.
Well, and when such a person comes forward, and it's determined they don't just think they're legitimate, but they actually are legitimate. They have documentation and so forth. What does the Government Accountability Project do? Do you help represent such folks legally, or is your hope to sort of point them towards resources to help them understand their rights and so forth?
Yeah, both. It depends. Mm-hmm. It depends. So a lot of people. So in the context of this project, this is going to be like a rapid response triage project from an election perspective, right? And of course, then we'll move into ensuring a peaceful transition of power, and then depending on what happens with the election results, we'll be working on fighting against authoritarianism. So, but hopefully we won't be in that land quite as much. We'll still be representing whistleblowers, but it'll be a different focus, right?
Yep.
But,
yep.
But historically, we represent whistleblowers who come to us if they're, on serious matters of concern, that are proven and that we can make a difference with.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that would be related to serious illegal interference in a battleground state would be something that we are really looking at with Democracy Protection Initiative. What we do, though, is help people understand their rights, risks, and options so they can make informed decisions. We can help them make disclosures in ways that are safe and effective. We also work with public interest partners, many of whom you've had on your show, to analyze and verify, to work on that verification and analysis mm-hmm. of the concern, and to think about how to move that information and deal with it safely and effectively. I think in this environment, sometimes what we would do, for instance, I represent a lot of whistleblowers in the immigration context, mm-hmm. nurses and doctors who have raised concerns about, harm to children and adults in mm-hmm. immigration detention. And often what we'll do is we'll explain to them their rights, risks, and options, make a decision about their comfort level, their goals, how vulnerable they feel. But ideally, if they can come to us early, we can help them make disclosures in ways that insulate them from retaliation and make it all about the message. And we can do that by sharing information with Congress, with oversight agencies, with law enforcement, and ideally also with the press and with public interest partners. So it becomes about movement and focus on the message to drive accountability. And I really see that's where whistleblowers are such an important piece of democracy itself. And this is like a micro application of it. The information provided by a whistleblower fuels those mechanisms of accountability that are our representative democracy, right? So they can be super powerful, and it's why they're very important tools in our, collective efforts to ensure free and fair elections. So yes, we would be providing representation. We would be providing legal and strategic support and advocacy. And it may be that means that they remain confidential. We try to sanitize uh-huh. their information so we can protect them in this environment, particularly where there's risks of violence and doxing, and it's very different than just losing your job.
Well, there's your guide notes by Simply Speaking Up. You can prevent possible illegal attempts at election sabotage by reporting on, for example, election workers who fail to be impartial or engage in partisanship by taking direction from a political party or party official, mm-hmm. election officials who turn a blind eye to intimidation. So what would be your advice for election workers who may see that sort of thing? And I guess, we're even talking about poll workers here. They might mm-hmm. see that, but they don't feel comfortable bringing it to their superior, or maybe
right.
it is the superior themselves who is doing that sort of behavior. What do you recommend someone like that do?
Exactly. So, so our first recommendation would be, if it's not their superior and they feel like their superior is in a position to do something about it, to raise the concern internally.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But in the situation that you talked about, where we are, worried that the both retaliation and the problem itself is coming from their superior, we advise them to ideally call us
mm-hmm.
Would be something that they could do. So we have, we'll have a rapid response, a hotline, at our website that's secure, where we're recruiting pro bono attorneys on the ground in all the different states to help with rapid response intakes. And we will also be able to move people if they're, for instance, if there's another organization that is expert or standing ready to do litigation or take that information, to also work in partnership with other organizations. So to make sure that, no one's log jammed. But what they should do is, they should call us. They should get legal help early
mm-hmm.
because they can, be best insulated and not have to do it alone.
And you can help them do
we can help them.
Right.
Yeah, that's okay. That's what we're, exactly. And if we can't help them, we will absolutely refer them, talk about, help them navigate their rights and put them, in touch with organizations that could. If we're able to help them, certainly directly, we will help represent them. But what they can do before that is to document everything. Write it down contemporaneously. That is important. If there's information to be able to, you know, make sure that's secure and collected, that if there are allies, to check for allies, you know, within their coworkers who may be able to, you know, support them, note witnesses, possibly date things. So I think there are ways, you know, again, to shore up the verification piece, which will be, you know, critical to be able to have to both insulate them and to make a difference.
And do we need to note here that in documenting these things, that they should not break the law to do so?
They should not break the law to do so. That's correct.
Well, the reason I ask is, you know, the U.S. and I understand. So from your program, it sounds like you're sort of targeting here everyone from the, you know, poll workers up through election officials, up through federal officials who oversee elections. But the U.S., as you know, Dana Gold, has sort of a mixed record on whistleblowers over the years. I mentioned our old friend Dan Ellsberg during the intro, who faced extraordinary legal consequences for his revelation of government lies and secrets during the Vietnam War, one of the reasons your organization came into being. And more recently, specifically on the election front, Dana, a national security whistleblower by the name of Reality Winner. She was sentenced to 5 years in prison for accurately revealing that, yes, Russian intelligence operatives really did sort of hack their way into voter registration systems before the 2016 elections, and that the government officials knew about that. Those are obviously both extraordinary situations, but both of them would suggest that, you know what, maybe it's better to be, keep quiet about such things. What would you say to someone like that?
Well, I think there are a couple of things I would say to that. So, two of the most important whistleblowers, you know, in U.S. history. I think the you know, what's interesting is that the law is a is the first thing we look at. But if that the law is all you got, that's still not great, right? But it is a place to insulate yourself, and that's why getting legal advice early is really important. And that is something that I think Reality Winner has even said, like, she did not seek legal advice as she was, you know, sending information, you know, to The Intercept.
Well, she went straight to the media, and a lot of people do that. A lot of potential whistleblowers will reach out to the media first. I don't want to dissuade them from doing that, you understand, Dana. But
yes, it's why we have a guide, though, for journalists about how to work with whistleblowers.
There you go.
Yes, because I think that whistleblowers don't, and that's why this is really important for us in terms of a strategy of trying to disseminate this guide to make election officials and workers and any employee aware of their rights, right, and their risks and options. Because journalists, for instance, who are super important, you know, critical partners to making a difference and insulating a whistleblower, they don't have a fiduciary duty, you know, to that employee, right, to protect their legal interests.
Right.
And so, and neither does a public interest organization that is not providing them an employee whistleblower with legal advice, right? They care about the information, but that information is tied to a person, which is why in this environment, you know, it's really important to get support as early as possible about your rights, risks, and options. And so, so that's the first thing. But, you know, I think what's interesting about, I used to talk about this with, you know, most whistleblowers are not dealing with classified information, right? Like we're not talking about classified information here, right? We're talking about documenting what you're seeing. That's really what I'm talking about. Like, what did you see? Who was there? You know, why is that wrong? Who did you tell? Right. If there's, you know, if there's evidence about, you know, if it's about, you know, taping something, how you release it can matter. You know, and that's why doing it with a lawyer is really important, because we have attorney-client privilege. And so that creates, you know, it's the most secure protection that an employee can have in terms of that confidence of confidentiality. You know, and that doesn't happen with reporters. I mean, they have to, there's a reporter's privilege, but really you guys have to go to jail to protect a source. It's not the same thing as me just saying, you know, if they're my client, I get, you know, what we talk about is privilege.
So I
think that, you know, letting people know about their rights, risks, and options, and working with journalists and public interest partners to whom a whistleblower might go, because they don't think of themselves as a whistleblower. They think of themselves as just an employee doing their job, and they don't know where to go. creating awareness among public interest partners who are doing election, you know, protection work with journalists on the ground to know. And that's a lot of our referrals come from public interest partners and journalists who say, I have a source. They need advice. They need legal protection. Can I send them to you? And that's a great thing. It's a super responsible thing for a journalist and a public interest partner to do. And we, because we're not just a normal law firm, like we are trying to make change and promote government and corporate accountability to protect the public interest, you know, we're going to work in partnership with journalists or public interest partners, because the goal of the whistleblower is to make a difference with their information. It's inherently why it's the definition of a whistleblower. It's because of their speech, right? They're seeing a problem that they, you know, that they need to have addressed. And so we're going to make sure that we, you know, we're different and that we know how to use different tools than just a lawyer in the toolbox, but anchored in protecting that source, that employee, because it is one of the hardest decisions. It can be life-changing. It is always life-changing to blow the whistle.
It really is. And I'll tell you what, you guys have done for decades now such critical work. I have greatly appreciated your work over the years at your organization, and I wish you and frankly all of us luck in this year's election.
I don't get a single phone call.
There you go. That's right. Yep. I hope to not hear from you, Dana, for many years. But anyway, so good luck on whatever may happen. I'm very grateful for the work you do, and I'm very grateful for you joining us today. Dana Gold is the Senior Director of Advocacy and Strategy at the Government Accountability Project and Director of their relatively new Democracy Protection Initiative. They can be found at, easy to remember, whistleblower.org. I will, of course, link to them when I post the show at BradBlog tonight, along with a direct link to their guide for potential election whistleblowers. Dana Gold can also be found on the Twitters at Dana L. Gold, and of course, so can Gap at Government Accountability Proj, P-R-O-J. Dana Gold, really great speaking with you today, and I look forward to doing so again in the future.
Thanks so much, Brad. Really, really appreciate you talking to me today.
Thank you so much. All right, well...
Well, I'm really glad that they are on the scene and they are there to help out whistleblowers. You know, they also have a climate integrity unit, the Climate Science Watch, that combats political interference in climate science and policymaking, and helping whistleblowers there as well.
Whistleblower.org. Anyway, we got to get out. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to, of course, Dana Gold. And to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other we have ever done since the beginning of time, you can download them for free at bradblog.com. What we do is supported by you. You are the folks who keep us on your public airwaves by hitting one of those donate buttons at bradblog.com, or you can just go straight to bradblog.com/donate. Please do. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site still known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.